The officers hit the two men several times, but the patrol officers' weapons, including one shotgun, couldn't penetrate the body armor. About 20 minutes later, an LAPD SWAT team showed up. At around 10 minutes before 10 a.m., Phillips's rifle jammed. He started firing with a pistol, then dropped that too after he was struck in the hand. He picked up the pistol and, about 20 minutes after the shootout began, shot himself in the head. Mara Sirianu tried to mount an escape in the Celebrity, but police had shot out the tires. He managed to move it a few blocks, where he attempted to commandeer a pickup truck. When he couldn't get it started, he took cover behind it just as the SWAT team arrived. He exchanged fire with them for a few minutes before surrendering. By then, he'd been shot at least 20 times, in his legs and other parts of his body unprotected by armor. He died before the ambulance arrived. By the end of the shootout, more than 300 law enforcement personnel fired approximately 650 total rounds at each of the two men. Phillips and Matasarianu fired 1,100 rounds between them. The shootout lasted 44 minutes. 11 police officers and 7 citizens were wounded. Phillips and Matasarianu were the only fatalities. Nearly all of the shootout was broadcast on live television by several local news helicopters. If you wanted to create an incident to win sympathy for police militarization, you couldn't do much better than the North Hollywood shootout. A live, televised shootout between hundreds of cops and two career criminals, heavily armed and armored, and who refused to go down, was a tailor-made poster case for soldiering up America's police forces. The following September, the Pentagon sent 600 M-16s to the Los Angeles Police Department for officers to put in their patrol cars. The department also authorized patrol officers to carry .45-caliber semi-automatic pistols. The incident moved other police departments across the country to upgrade patrol officer sidearms as well. In the 15 years since it happened, the North Hollywood shootout has become the go-to incident for proponents of police militarization. For years now, it has been regularly cited as the prime example of why cops need bigger guns and why police departments need SWAT teams. There's some merit to these arguments. A strong argument could be made, for example, for allowing patrol officers to store powerful weapons in the trunks of their squad cars in the event that they're the first on the scene of such an incident, and the SWAT team is still 10 or 20 minutes away. But the incident isn't an argument for the proliferation of SWAT teams to small towns, for more militarized uniforms, or for using increasingly militarized tactics for increasingly petty crimes. Given that the only two fatalities at North Hollywood were the criminals themselves, and that the incident happened 15 years ago, the incident's staying power as an anecdote is in some ways puzzling. But in other ways, perhaps it isn't. That the best anecdote defenders of police militarization can come up with is 15 years old may attest to the rarity of such incidents. In any case, even most critics of the SWAT phenomenon acknowledge that there are some situations where a paramilitary police response is appropriate, and a heavily armed bank robbery would be right at the top of that list. The criticism of SWAT proliferation is that the overwhelming majority of SWAT deployments today are to break into private residences to serve search warrants for nonviolent crimes. Phillips and Matasarianu committed armed robberies, crimes for which violence is a prerequisite. The other major incident from the late 1990s that proponents of militarization often cite in justifying SWAT teams is the 1999 mass shooting at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. But if the justification for SWAT teams is to have a team of brave, highly trained, highly professional, well-armed, and well-protected cops to intervene in such tragedies, Columbine is a particularly unfortunate example. Though there were eventually 800 police officers and 8 SWAT teams on the Columbine campus, the SWAT teams held off from going inside to stop shooters Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris because they deemed the situation too dangerous. A spokesman for the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department justified the SWAT team's actions after the shooting. A dead police officer would not be able to help anyone. Added SWAT team leader Don Kramer, "If we went in and tried to take them and got shot, we would be part of the problem." David Koppel of the Independence Institute in Colorado explained how that panned out for the victims. While one murder after another was being perpetrated, a dozen police officers were stationed near the exit. These officers made no attempt to enter the building, walk 15 steps, and confront the murderers. According to police speaking on condition of anonymity, one Denver SWAT officer did begin to enter but was immediately ordered down by commanders. 20 minutes after the rampage began, three SWAT officers were finally sent into the building, on the first floor, on the side of the building furthest from the library, where killings were in progress. Finding students rushing out of the building, they decided to escort students out rather than track down the killers. This began a police program to contain the perimeter. Instead of confronting the killers, then, the SWAT team frisked the victims. They then passed on another chance to confront Harris and Klebold. The two murderers eventually tired of the library killings and went downstairs to the cafeteria. More students were hiding in a room nearby with the door locked. The two murderers attempted to shoot off the lock and enter that room. Students in the room had called 911, and the line was open. So again, the killer's location was known. Many officers were massed near the cafeteria door. They knew where the murderers were. They knew that the murderers were attempting to get into a room to kill more people. The police stood idle. Harris and Klebold killed themselves in the library. Not knowing that, and still considering it too dangerous to enter the portions of the building where there had been known gunfire, it took more than 3 hours for the SWAT team to finally reach the victims. In the meantime, science teacher David Sanders bled to death on the second floor. He might have survived had he received reasonably prompt medical attention. He was still alive when police finally reached him, 3 hours after he'd been shot. He died during the additional 45 minutes it took paramedics to reach him. Students in his classroom had put up a sign in the window to alert the police to his condition. It read, "One bleeding to death." The LAPD SWAT team was later asked to review the actions of their colleagues in Jefferson County. They found that the officers had followed standard procedure. Perhaps that was just an act of professional courtesy. If not, consider the implications. Columbine was precisely the sort of incident for which the SWAT team had been invented. It was the sort of incident often cited by defenders of SWAT teams to justify their existence. And it was the sort of incident for which even critics of SWAT teams concede the use of a SWAT team would be appropriate. Yet not only did the SWAT teams at the scene not confront the killers, potentially costing innocent lives, but the most respected SWAT team in the country then reviewed the Jefferson County team's actions and found their actions were appropriate. In the following years, Littleton and North Hollywood would be cited ad nauseum by police officials in towns and counties across the country agitating for their own SWAT team, or defending or arguing for more weaponry for the one they already had. When the town of Ithaca, New York, reformulated its SWAT team in 2000, for example, Assistant Commander Peter Tyler was asked why a college town with virtually no violent crime needed a SWAT team in the first place. He pointed to Columbine and similar mass shootings. "I think it's naive for anyone to think it couldn't happen here in Ithaca," he said. Perhaps, but in a different context. Ithaca Police Chief Richard Basile later explained that the reformulated SWAT team would save taxpayers money because its smaller size made it more efficient at its primary duty, serving drug warrants. A 2002 Miami Herald article on the spread of SWAT teams in Florida noted that police say they want SWAT teams in case of a hostage situation or a Columbine-type incident, but in practice, the teams are used mainly to serve search warrants on suspected drug dealers. Some of these searches yield as little as a few grams of cocaine or marijuana. As recently as July 2012, Portland, Maine Police Chief Michael Soschuk cited both incidents to justify his department's acquisition of a military-grade armored truck. There have, of course, been a number of other school shootings since Columbine, on both high school and college campuses, and some, like Virginia Tech, have ended with horrifically high body counts. But most such shootings are also over within seconds, far less time than it would take a typical SWAT team to scramble to the scene. One possible exception is Newtown, where a Connecticut State Police SWAT team arrived quickly, and their presence reportedly persuaded shooter Adam Lanza to kill himself instead of killing more children. It's also important to note that, though they make huge headlines and spark weeks of breathless coverage, school shootings and mass shootings in general are exceedingly rare. University of Virginia psychologist and education professor Dewey Cornell, who studies violence prevention and school safety, has estimated that the typical school campus can expect to see a homicide about once every several thousand years. Hardly justification to rush out to get a SWAT team. Yet many college campuses now have their own paramilitary police teams, and many cited Columbine and Virginia Tech as the reason they needed one. A recent example is the University of North Carolina Charlotte Campus Police Department, which started a SWAT team in 2011. Lieutenant Josh Huffman explained why it was necessary. The purpose for creating the UNCC SWAT team is to protect the community and prevent the loss of life. We must be prepared to respond to high-risk situations, such as those tragedies that occurred at Virginia Tech and Columbine. The number of campuses that will ever host a mass shooting or hostage-taking may be vanishingly small, but most campuses produce more than enough pot smokers, and thus dealers to supply them, to keep the SWAT team busy once it's up and running. Oddly enough, the move toward aggressive, even preventative crackdowns on protesters by cops decked out in riot gear kicked into high gear during protests in a city whose police chief was a self-described progressive hippie. The head of the Seattle Police Department during the 1999 World Trade Organization, WTO, protests was Norm Stamper, the same guy who pioneered community policing and tried to demilitarize the police in San Diego. It wasn't that the police in Seattle weren't prepared. The police department had gone through 10,000 hours of training in the weeks leading up to the event. The state-of-the-art riot gear they had ordered gave them a look that Stamper likened, in his book Breaking Rank, to Darth Vader. When the police come to a protest dressed like that, armed and expecting confrontation, both police and protesters start to think that a confrontation is inevitable. This was why, at the height of the often violent protests of the 1970s, Washington, D.C. Police Chief Jerry Wilson put cops in traditional police blues on the front lines, but kept his riot squad on buses parked on side streets, ready but out of sight. Stamper says today that he didn't have the luxury of keeping the cops clad in riot gear off to the side while putting uniformed guys on the front lines. He simply didn't have enough personnel to do both. It was a large event for a city of Seattle's size. But there were also reports that law enforcement officials, and there were at least a dozen agencies handling security at the conference, vastly overestimated the size of the protests. Again, an indication that over-preparation by the security planners may have given the cops who worked the event a distorted impression of what they were about to face, an impression that then became self-fulfilling. After all the training the department had gone through, was done, and the event was just days away. Stamper writes, "He as a commander was feeling confident. We've got this sucker covered," he recalls thinking. But the cops themselves were less assured. They appreciated the training. They loved the new equipment, Stamper writes. But they were convinced that the city was in for a real shitstorm. And that's what they got. Mid-morning on the first day, demonstrators surged into an intersection and took a seat, locking arms to form what Stamper called one massive knot of humanity. A police department field commander told them they'd be arrested. When they didn't move, he warned them again, and several more times. Then he hit them with gas. Despite the hours and hours of training, the cops lobbed the tear gas canisters behind the frontline protesters, giving them the option of either running into plumes of gas or surging into a line of police officers. That created chaos. By the time the first day turned to evening, Seattle Mayor Paul Schell had declared a state of emergency, imposed a curfew, and banned protests in and around the conference. He also made it a crime to possess a gas mask, an order that almost certainly exceeded his authority and was probably unconstitutional. Rioters and cops continued to clash. The next day, Washington Governor Gary Locke called in the National Guard. A Seattle City Council investigation would later find that the police who handled the event were panic-stricken, driven by exaggerated crowd estimates and unfounded rumors. One such rumor later determined to be untrue was that protesters were tossing Molotov cocktails. The riots resulted in $20 million in damage to local businesses. But even the vandals, looters, and anarchists never turned violent. There were no fatalities and fewer than 100 injuries, the most serious of which was a broken arm. In 2004, the city reached a financial settlement with 157 protesters who had been illegally arrested. And in 2007, a federal jury found that the city had violated the Fourth Amendment rights of 170 more. Norm Stamper took responsibility for the disaster and resigned as Seattle police chief, though he defended the decision to tear gas peaceful protesters in his 2005 book. He now says he was wrong. In fact, he says, it was the worst mistake of his career. "I changed my mind during my book tour," Stamper says. "After I had given a talk in Seattle to promote the book, a guy who had been gassed at the protests in Seattle came up to me and said to me, in a soft voice, 'I had such hope and such respect for you, and I just lost it. I just can't accept your explanation for why you used tear gas on nonviolent people. I just can't accept that.'" Stamper told the man they'd just have to agree to disagree. But when the tour was over, he says he began to question his own rationale. "I finally turned the corner shortly before a speech to an ACLU gathering at the University of Washington. I told the story about the protests, about the man who had come up to me during my book tour, and I talked about how I had changed my mind. And I said, the more I thought about it, the more I thought it was the worst professional mistake I had ever made. I didn't realize it, but the same guy was in the audience that night. He came up to me afterward in tears." The battle for Seattle is commonly considered the start of the modern anti-globalization movement. But it was also a landmark event in the way police and city officials react to protests. In spite of the fact that there were few injuries and no fatalities, the images that emerged from Seattle depicted a city that had lost control. Going forward, control would be the prevailing objectives for police handling protests. In the years to come, the Darth Vader look would become the standard police presence at large protests. Cities and police officials would commit mass violations of civil and constitutional rights and deal with the consequences later. There would be violent, preemptive SWAT raids, mass arrests, and sweeping use of police powers that ensnared violent protesters, peaceful protesters, and people who had nothing to do with the protest at all. That's why Stamper calls his decisions in Seattle the worst mistake of his career. He's seen how the police response to protests has changed since 1999. "We gassed fellow Americans engaging in civil disobedience," Stamper says. "We set a number of precedents, most of them bad, and police departments across the country learned all the wrong lessons from us." That's disheartening, so disheartening. I mean, you look at what happened to those Occupy protesters at UC Davis, where the cop just pepper sprays them down like he's watering a bed of flowers. And I think that we played a part in making that sort of thing so common, so easy to do now. It's beyond cringeworthy. I wish to hell my career had ended on a happier note. The numbers. Number of SWAT raids conducted by the Minneapolis Police Department in 1987. 36. Number of SWAT raids conducted by the Minneapolis Police Department in 1996. Over 700. Number of raids carried out by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms from 1993 to 1995, 523. Percentage of these ATF raids that used dynamic entry, 49%. Percentage of these ATF raids that turned up weapons of any kind, 18%. Approximate number of paramilitary police raids in the United States in 1980, 3,000. Approximate number of paramilitary police raids in 1995, 30,000. Approximate number of paramilitary police raids in 2001, 45,000. Number of SWAT deployments in Orange County, Florida, from 1993 to 1997, 619. Percentage of those SWAT deployments undertaken to serve drug warrants, 94%. Number of police officers in the Tactical Operations Branch of the Portland, Oregon Police Department in 1989, 2. Number of Portland police officers in the Tactical Operations Branch in 1994, 56. Percentage of police departments in cities of 100,000 or more that had a SWAT team in 1982, 59%. In 1995, 89%. Average number of times each of those SWAT teams was deployed in 1980, 13. In 1989, 38. In 1995, 52. Percentage increase in the number of police departments using tactical units for proactive patrol from 1982 to 1997, 292%. Chapter 8. The 2000s. A Whole New War. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Sheriff Leon Lott of Richland County, South Carolina, quoting Matthew chapter 5, verse 9, in a press release announcing his acquisition of a track-propelled armored personnel carrier with a belt-fed rotating machine gun turret capable of firing 50-caliber rounds of ammunition. Betty Taylor still remembers the night it all hit her. As a child, Taylor had always been taught that police officers were the good guys. She learned to respect law enforcement, as she puts it, all the time, all the way. She went on to become a cop because she wanted to help people, and that's what cops did. She wanted to fight sexual assault, particularly predators who take advantage of children. To go into law enforcement, to become one of the good guys, seemed like the best way to accomplish that. By the late 1990s, she'd risen to the rank of detective in the Sheriff's Department of Lincoln County, Missouri, a sparsely populated farming community about an hour northwest of St. Louis. She eventually started a sex crimes unit within the department. But it was a small department with a tight budget. When she couldn't get the money she needed, Taylor was forced to give speeches and write her own proposals to keep her program operating. What troubled her was that, while the sex crimes unit had to find funding on its own, the SWAT team was always flush with cash. The SWAT team, the drug guys, they always had money, Taylor says. There were always state and federal grants for drug raids. There was always funding through asset forfeiture. Taylor never quite understood that disparity. When you think about the collateral effects of a sex crime, of how it can affect an entire family, an entire community, it just didn't make sense. The drug users weren't really harming anyone but themselves. Even the dealers, I found, much of the time they were just people with little money, just trying to get by. The SWAT team eventually co-opted her as a member, as the only woman in the department. She was asked to go along on drug raids in the event there were any children inside. The perimeter team would go in first. They'd throw all of the adults on the floor until they had secured the building, sometimes the kids, too. Then they'd put the kids in a room by themselves, and the search team would go in. They'd come to me, point to where the kids were, and say, "You deal with them." Taylor would then stay with the children until family services arrived, at which point they'd be placed with a relative. Taylor's moment of clarity came during a raid on an autumn evening in November 2000. Narcotics investigators had made a controlled drug buy a few hours earlier and were laying plans to raid the suspect's home. The drug buy was in town, not at the home, Taylor says. But they'd always raid the house anyway. They could never just arrest the guy on the street. They always had to kick down doors. With just 3 hours between the drug buy and the raid, the police hadn't done much surveillance at all. The SWAT team would often avoid raiding a house if they knew there were children inside. But Taylor was troubled by how little effort they put into seeking out that sort of information. 3 hours is nowhere near enough time to investigate your suspect, to find out who might be inside the house. It just isn't enough time for you to know the range of things that could happen. That afternoon, the police had bought drugs from the stepfather of two children, ages 8 and 6. Both were in the house at the time of the raid. The stepfather wasn't. They did their thing, Taylor says. Everybody on the floor, guns and yelling. Then they put the two kids in the bedroom, did their search, then sent me in to take care of the kids. Taylor made her way inside to see them. When she opened the door, the 8-year-old girl assumed a defense posture, putting herself between Taylor and her little brother. She looked at Taylor and said, half fearful, half angry, "What are you going to do to us?" Taylor was shattered. Here I come in with all my SWAT gear on, dressed in armor from head to toe, and this little girl looks up at me, and her only thought is to defend her little brother. I thought, how can we be the good guys when we come into the house looking like this, screaming and pointing guns at the people they love? How can we be the good guys when a little girl looks up at me and wants to fight me? And for what? What were we accomplishing with all of this? Absolutely nothing. Taylor was later appointed police chief of the small town of Winfield, Missouri. Winfield was too small for its own SWAT team, even in the 2000s, but Taylor says she'd have quit before she ever created one. Good police work has nothing to do with dressing up in black and breaking into houses in the middle of the night. And the mentality changes when they get put on the SWAT team. I remember a guy I was good friends with. It just completely changed him. The us versus them mentality takes over. You see that mentality in regular patrol officers, too, but it's much, much worse on the SWAT team. They're more concerned with the drugs than they are with innocent bystanders, because when you get into that mentality, there are no innocent people. There's us, and there's the enemy. Children and dogs are always the easiest casualties. Taylor recently ran into the little girl who changed the way she thought about policing. Now in her 20s, the girl told Taylor that she and her brother had nightmares for years after the raid. They slept in the same bed until the boy was 11. "That was a difficult day at work for me," she says. But for her, this was the most traumatic, defining moment of this girl's life. "Do you know what we found? We didn't find any weapons. No big drug operation. We found 3 joints and a pipe." Police militarization would accelerate in the 2000s. The first half of the decade brought a new and lucrative source of funding and equipment, Homeland Security. In response to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, on the World Trade Center in New York City and the Pentagon in Washington, the federal government opened a new spigot of funding in the name of fighting terror. Terrorism would also provide new excuses for police agencies across the country to build up their arsenals, and for yet smaller towns to start up yet more SWAT teams. The second half of the decade also saw more mission creep for SWAT teams, and more pronounced militarization even outside of drug policing. The 1990s trend of government officials using paramilitary tactics and heavy-handed force to make political statements, or to make an example of certain classes of nonviolent offenders, would continue, especially in response to political protests. The battle gear and aggressive policing would also start to move into more mundane crimes. SWAT teams have recently been used even for regulatory inspections. But the last few years have also seen some trends that could spur some movement toward reform. Technological advances in personal electronic devices have armed a large percentage of the public with the power to hold police more accountable with video and audio recordings. The rise of social media has enabled citizens to get accounts of police abuses out and quickly disseminated. This has led to more widespread coverage of botched raids and spread awareness of how often, and for what purpose this sort of force is being used. Over just the 6 years I've been covering this issue, I've noticed that media accounts of drug raids have become less deferential to police. Reporters have become more willing to ask questions about the appropriateness of police tactics, and more likely to look at how a given raid fits into broader policing trends, both locally and nationally. Internet commenters on articles about incidents in which police may have used excessive force also seem to have grown more skeptical about police actions, particularly in botched drug raids. It's taken nearly a half century to get from those Supreme Court decisions in the mid-1960s to where we are today. Police militarization has happened gradually over decades. We tend not to take notice of such long-developing trends, even when they directly affect us. The first and perhaps largest barrier to halting police militarization has probably been awareness. And that at least seems to be changing. Whether it leads to any substantive change may be the theme of the current decade. By the mid-1990s, the Byrne Grant Program Congress had started in 1988 had pushed police departments across the country to prioritize drug crimes over other investigations. When applying for grants, departments are rewarded with funding for statistics such as the number of overall arrests, the number of warrants served, or the number of drug seizures. Those priorities, then, are passed down to police officers themselves and are reflected in how they're evaluated, reviewed, and promoted. Perversely, actual success in reducing crime is generally not rewarded with federal money, on the presumption that the money ought to go where it's most needed, high crime areas. So the grants reward police departments for making lots of easy arrests, i.e. low-level drug offenders, and lots of seizures, regardless of size, and for serving lots of warrants. When it comes to tapping into federal funds, whether any of that actually reduces crime or makes the community safer is irrelevant. And in fact, successfully fighting crime could hurt a department's ability to rake in federal money. But the most harmful product of the Byrne Grant Program may be its creation of hundreds of regional and multi-jurisdictional narcotics task forces. That term, narcotics task force, pops up frequently in the case studies and horror stories throughout this book. There's a reason for that. While the Reagan and Bush administrations had set up a number of drug task forces in border zones, the Byrne Grant Program established similar task forces all across the country. They seemed particularly likely to pop up in rural areas that didn't yet have a paramilitary police team, what few were left. The task forces are staffed with local cops drawn from the police agencies in the jurisdictions where the task force operates. Some squads loosely report to a state law enforcement agency, but oversight tends to be minimal to non-existent. Because their funding comes from the federal government, and whatever asset forfeiture proceeds they reap from their investigations, local officials can't even control them by cutting their budget. This organizational structure makes some task forces virtually unaccountable, and certainly not accountable to any public official in the region they cover. As a result, we have roving squads of drug cops loaded with SWAT gear who get more money if they conduct more raids, make more arrests, and seize more property. And they are virtually immune to accountability if they get out of line. In 2009, the Justice Department attempted a cost-benefit analysis of these task forces, but couldn't even get to the point of crunching the numbers. The task forces weren't producing any numbers to crunch. Not only were data insufficient to estimate what task forces accomplished, the report read, data were inadequate to even tell what the task forces did for routine work. Not surprisingly, the proliferation of heavily armed task forces that have little accountability and are rewarded for making lots of busts has resulted in some abuse. The most notorious scandal involving these task forces came in the form of a massive drug sting in the town of Tulia, Texas. On July 23, 1999, the task force donned black ski mask caps and full SWAT gear to conduct a series of coordinated pre-dawn raids across Tulia. By 4 a.m., 40 black people, 10% of Tulia's black population, and six whites were in handcuffs. The Tulia Sentinel declared, "We do not like these scumbags doing business in our town. They are a cancer in our community. It's time to give them a major dose of chemotherapy behind bars." The paper followed up with the headline, "Tulia's Streets Cleared of Garbage." The raids were based on the investigative work of Tom Coleman, a sort of freelance cop who, it would later be revealed, had simply invented drug transactions that had never occurred. The first trials resulted in convictions based entirely on the credibility of Tom Coleman. the defendants received long sentences. For those who were arrested but still awaiting trial, plea bargains that let them avoid prison time began to look attractive, even if they were innocent. Coleman was even named Texas Lawman of the Year. But there were some curious details about the raids. For such a large drug bust, the task force hadn't recovered any actual drugs, or any weapons, for that matter. And it wasn't for a lack of looking. The task force cops had all but destroyed the interiors of the homes they raided. Then, some cases started falling apart. One woman Coleman claimed sold him drugs could prove she was in Oklahoma City at the time. Coleman had described another woman as 6 months pregnant. She wasn't. Another suspect could prove he was at work during the alleged drug sale. By 2004, nearly all of the 46 suspects were either cleared or pardoned by Texas Governor Rick Perry. The jurisdictions the task force served eventually settled a lawsuit with the defendants for $6 million. In 2005, Coleman was convicted of perjury. He received 10 years probation and was fined $7,500. The following year, it all happened again. In November 2000, SWAT teams from the Byrne-funded South Central Texas Narcotics Task Force rolled into Hearn, a town of about 5,000 people in Robertson County, to wage another series of coordinated raids. The raids netted 28 arrests. 27 of the suspects were black. One of them was Regina Kelly, a single mother. Kelly wasn't home when her house was raided. She was waiting tables at a local diner. The police marched her off the job in handcuffs and tossed her in a jail cell. She first thought she had been arrested for unpaid parking tickets. Kelly's court-appointed attorney encouraged her to take a plea bargain, plead guilty, and she'd get 18 years probation. She'd get no prison time and wouldn't lose her kids. She refused. "I wasn't going to plead guilty to something I didn't do," she told me in a 2007 interview. The attorney went back to D.A. John Paschal, who then offered 5 years probation. Kelly again refused and told her attorney to ask for the evidence they had used to indict her. Her attorney brought back a tape recording the D.A.'s office claimed was evidence of her drug sales. The tape recording was a conversation between two men. There were no female voices, and Kelly's name was never mentioned. Kelly's bail was then reduced from $70,000 to $10,000. Her parents were able to post bond, and she never had to go to court again. She was eventually cleared of any criminal wrongdoing. In part because of Kelly's courageous refusal to accept a plea bargain for a crime she didn't commit, we now know that all 28 indictments were based on the word of a single, confidential informant. Paschal's office was forced to admit that the informant had both tampered with evidence and failed a polygraph test. At the civil trial for the lawsuit brought by Kelly and other defendants, the informant testified that Paschal had given him a list of 20 black men. He promised leniency for the informant's own burglary charge if he helped Paschal convict the men on the list. The informant also testified he was promised $100 for every suspect he helped convict beyond that list of 20. The lawsuit was settled in 2005. Of the 28 people charged, 17 were later exonerated. The 2008 movie American Violet was based on Kelly's experience after she was arrested. But similar mass roundup raids had been going on in Hearn for 15 years. "They come on helicopters, military style, SWAT style," Kelly told me. "In the apartments I was living in the projects, there were a lot of children outside playing. They don't care. They throw kids on the ground, put guns to their heads. They're kicking in doors. They just don't care." In the following years, there were numerous other corruption scandals, botched raids, sloppy police work, and other allegations of misconduct against the federally funded task forces in Texas. Things got so that, by the middle of the 2000s, Governor Rick Perry began diverting state matching funds away from the task forces to other programs. The cut in funding forced many task forces to shut down. The stream of lawsuits shut down or limited the operations of others. In 2001, the state had 51 federally funded task forces. By the spring of 2006, it was down to 22. Funding for the Byrne Grant Program had held steady at about $500 million through most of the Clinton administration. Just as it had done with the COPS program, the Bush administration began to pare the program down, to about $170 million by 2008. This was more out of an interest in limiting federal influence on law enforcement than concern for police abuse or drug war excesses. But the reaction from law enforcement was interesting. In March 2008, Byrne-funded task forces across the country staged a series of coordinated drug raids dubbed Operation Byrne Blitz. The intent was to make a series of large drug seizures to demonstrate how important the Byrne grants were to fighting the drug war. In Kentucky alone, for example, task forces uncovered 23 methamphetamine labs, seized more than 2,400 pounds of marijuana, and arrested 565 people for illegal drug use. Of course, if police in a single state could simply go out and find 23 meth labs and 2,400 pounds of marijuana in 24 hours just to make a political point about drug war funding, that was probably a good indication that 20 years of Byrne grants and 4 decades of drug warring hadn't really accomplished much. During the 2008 presidential campaign, Barack Obama criticized Bush and the Republicans for cutting Byrne, a federal police program beloved by his running mate Joe Biden. Despite Tulia, Hearn, a growing pile of bodies from botched drug raids, and the objections of groups as diverse as the ACLU, the Heritage Foundation, La Raza, and the Cato Institute, Obama promised to restore full funding to the program, which, he said, has been critical to creating the anti-gang and anti-drug task forces our communities need. He kept his promise. The 2009 American Recovery and Reinvestment Act resuscitated the Byrne grants with a whopping $2 billion infusion, by far the largest budget in the program's 20-year history. Early in the morning of September 13, 2000, agents from the DEA, the FBI, and a Stanislaus County, California narcotics task force conducted raids on 14 homes in and around Modesto, the culmination of a 19-month investigation. One of the homes was that of Moises Sepulveda and his family. According to the Los Angeles Times, the DEA and FBI asked that the local SWAT teams enter each home unannounced in order to secure the area ahead of the federal agents, who would then come to serve the warrants and search for evidence. Federal agents warned the SWAT teams that the targets of the warrants should be considered armed and dangerous. When local police asked if there were any children in the Sepulveda home, the feds answered, not aware of any. There were. Moises Sepulveda had 3 children, a daughter and 2 sons. After the police forcibly entered the Sepulveda home, Moises, his wife, and his children were ordered to lie face down on the floor with their arms outstretched. They were then told to remain still as officers pointed guns at their heads. 11-year-old Alberto was doing just that, lying still under the gun of Officer David Hahn. But shortly after the raid began, Hahn's gun went off. The boy died instantly. There were no drugs or guns in the Sepulveda home. A subsequent internal investigation by the Modesto Police Department found that the DEA's evidence against Moises Sepulveda, who had no previous criminal record, was minimal. The city of Modesto and the federal government settled a lawsuit brought by the Sepulvedas for the death of their son for $3 million. In response to the incident, California Attorney General Bill Lockyer assembled a Blue Ribbon Commission to review the procedures, guidelines, and performance of the state's hundreds of SWAT teams. The Modesto Bee reported in 2001 that the commission would look at the way SWAT teams were deployed, the use of intimidating clothing and equipment, and, in the words of one commissioner, the overbearing-type attitudes of SWAT teams. Unsurprisingly, the commission found that while SWAT teams were generally justified, defended, and regarded as responders to emergency situations like hostage crises and terror attacks, they were most commonly being used to serve drug warrants. Nevertheless, the panel's final recommendations did little to address the number of SWAT teams, how they were being used, or police militarism in general. The panel's chief complaint was that SWAT teams were undertrained and underfunded, suggesting that local, state, and federal government should be throwing more funding and resources at SWAT teams, not less. The other recommendations consisted largely of standardizing procedures, definitions, and guidelines, and communicating better with the public. The commission didn't address any of the more urgent problems that had plagued the state's SWAT teams over the previous 20 years, such as SWAT teams launching raids based on uncorroborated tips from informants, asset forfeiture incentivizing the use of aggressive policing, or prosecutors and judges neglecting their duty to scrutinize the warrants authorizing these violent raids. In the end, even if every SWAT team in the state had implemented the panel's recommendations, and they were by no means obligated to, it's unlikely that much would have changed. In fact, if the suggestions had been implemented in the 1990s, it seems unlikely that they would have prevented the death of Alberto Sepúlveda, the reason for Lockyer's panel in the first place. Back in the early 1970s, nationwide outrage over a series of wrongdoer drug raids had inspired furious politicians to hastily call congressional hearings. As a consequence, the law that had authorized those raids was repealed. Now, in 2000, an 11-year-old boy had just been obliterated at close range with a shotgun as his parents and siblings lay on the ground beside him. And even that wasn't enough to stop his own town from discontinuing the aggressive tactics that caused his death. The mistakes, the terrorizing of innocents, and the unnecessary fatalities would continue. The George W. Bush administration quickly made it clear that the drug war would once again be fought as a culture war. Bush appointed only one drug czar in his two terms. John Walters was a longtime aide to William Bennett, who, like Bennett, took a hard-line, zero-tolerance approach to drugs. But when the 9/11 attacks happened 8 months after Bush was inaugurated, they presented a new opportunity. Instead of exploiting the fear of crime or tapping into what remained of anti-counterculture sentiment, they could now exploit the fear of terrorist attacks. They would use the 9/11 attacks for drug war propaganda. And so, starting in the February following the attacks, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, ONDCP, started the I Helped campaign, which consisted of commercial and print ads claiming that casual drug users in the United States were supporting the very sorts of terrorists that had attacked America. The television commercials featured a series of young people portrayed as casual drug users. One by one, the young actors rattled off the varieties of atrocity allegedly funded by recreational drug use. "I helped kill a policeman," one said. "I helped murder families," said another. "I helped kidnap people's dads," said still another. The ads aired during the 2002 Super Bowl, just after a September 11th-themed halftime show that featured a running scroll of the names of the 9/11 victims, accompanied by a performance by the band U2. The campaign was not only shamefully exploitative, it was simply false. The claim that casual drug users supported terrorism was dubious at best. To the extent that black market drug purchases in the United States did support terror groups, it was the black market part that made it possible. Nearly all of the terror attacks listed on the DEA's website at the time had been attacks by drug smuggling groups related to the drug trade, and nearly all had taken place in Latin America and Mexico. The only widely used drug in the United States with any tangible connection to terrorism of the 9/11 variety was heroin, and even that link was tenuous. By the federal government's own estimates, 82% of U.S. heroin came from Mexico and South America. A small percentage was domestically grown, and much of the rest came from a slew of countries in Asia, only a few of which were host to active anti-American terrorist groups. There was just no evidence that Al-Qaeda operatives were selling pot to Americans to fund their schemes to slam airplanes into buildings. But that was the line the government was pushing. The DEA would later put on a touring museum exhibit with the same themes. It included pieces of rubble from the World Trade Center. If anything, there was a stronger argument that the country's anti-drug efforts were sponsoring terrorism. In May 2001, just 4 months before September 11th, the U.S. State Department announced a $43 million aid gift to Afghanistan, which at the time was ruled by the Taliban. The grant was intended to be used to compensate Afghan farmers who had been hurt by a Taliban edict, encouraged by the United States, banning the cultivation of opium poppies. Of course, the edict didn't really stop the heroin from flowing out of Afghanistan. It simply enabled the Taliban to consolidate heroin production so that more of the revenue went directly to the regime. The United States had also given aid to support a drug war in Thailand that included government death squads, that human rights groups accused of carrying out as many as 4,000 extrajudicial executions of suspected drug offenders. U.S. aid had also gone to right-wing paramilitary groups in Colombia that were accused of mass human rights abuses. From a broader view, the ads weren't all that different from prior attempts to associate drugs and intoxicants with whatever bogeyman the country happened to be facing at the time. But by tying even casual drug users to terrorism so soon after one of the most horrific attacks on U.S. soil in the country's history, particularly an attack that took the lives of so many police officers, the federal government afforded drug cops yet more moral license to treat suspected drug offenders as enemy combatants, not as citizens with rights. Bush also continued Clinton's assault on medical marijuana. In the 2000 campaign, Bush had promised a federalist approach to the issue. He had said he would leave it to the states to decide. That promise didn't last long. It quickly became clear that, like Clinton before him, Bush would give no quarter to sick people using pot in states that had legalized it for treatment. The aggressive raids that began during the Clinton administration increased in both number and intensity. The result was the perverse spectacle of armed federal cops taking down medical facilities and their patients. On September 5, 2002, for example, federal agents raided the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana in Santa Cruz, California. Suzanne File, a post-polio patient who couldn't walk without leg braces and crutches, told columnist Mitch Albom that she awoke to find federal agents pointing assault rifles at her head. They yelled at her to get up. She said she couldn't. They yelled at her some more. She explained again that she was crippled. They finally handcuffed File to her bed, then moved on to other patients. Because she was allergic to many classes of drugs, File smoked marijuana to alleviate muscle and nerve pain brought on by her condition. On the same day, federal agents also raided the home of the facility's owners, Valerie and Michael Coral. A DEA SWAT team, decked out in flak jackets and M16s, stormed the house, shoved Valerie Coral to the ground, and put a gun to her head. She was cuffed, arrested, and taken to a federal detention center, still wearing her pajamas. When asked if such heavy-handed tactics were necessary, given that Valerie Coral was hardly a dangerous drug kingpin, DEA spokesman Will Glaspie replied, "We target drug traffickers. There is no such term as medical marijuana, except as created by the marijuana lobby." A week later, agents raided the Genesis 129 medical cannabis dispensary and the grower that supplied it. California Attorney General Bill Lockyer was angry, protesting, "A medical marijuana provider such as the Santa Cruz Collective represents little danger to the public and is certainly not a concern which would warrant diverting scarce federal resources." The heavy-handed federal enforcement on medical providers wasn't limited to marijuana. As fears about prescription opioid painkillers started to take root in the media in the early 2000s, the DEA began targeting doctors, and it has been doing so ever since. These are professionals with medical degrees, practices, offices, and patients singled out for allegedly overprescribing a certain class of drugs. There's still a debate over whether overprescribing these drugs, as defined by drug cops, not other doctors, should even be a crime, and whether some of the doctors were even overprescribing in the first place. Those questions aside, it's hard to fathom why it would be necessary to send SWAT teams to storm their homes and offices, subjecting their families and patients to the violence and volatility of a typical raid. The federal government wasn't even pretending anymore. Alleged states' rights supporters, like Asa Hutchinson, the head of DEA appointed by Bush in 2001, and Attorney General John Ashcroft, were making an example of these doctors, these dispensaries, and the people who owned, supplied, and patronized them. The guns and commando tactics were completely unnecessary. No reasonable person believed that Susan File, or Valerie Coral, was going to take out a couple of DEA agents in a suicidal blaze of glory. Most of the dispensaries were operating openly, within state law. Bush, Walters, Hutchison, Ashcroft, and the rest of the administration's drug policy team were using state-sanctioned violence to make a political point. "We're going to have our own tank," Keene, New Hampshire Mayor Kendall Lane whispered to Councilman Mitch Greenwald during a December 2011 city council meeting. It wasn't quite a tank, but the quaint town of 23,000, home to just two murders since 1999, had just accepted a $285,933 grant from the Department of Homeland Security to purchase a Bearcat, an 8-ton armored personnel vehicle made by Lenco Industries Incorporated. Since the September 11th attacks, Homeland Security had been handing out anti-terrorism grants like parade candy, giving cities and towns across the country funds to buy military-grade armored vehicles, guns, armor, aircraft, and other equipment. Companies like Lenco have thrived, creating yet another class of government hardware contractors, and a new interest group to lobby Washington to ensure the process of police militarization continues. These DHS grants have dwarfed the 1033 program. At the end of 2011, the Center for Investigative Reporting, CIR, found that Homeland Security had given out at least $34 billion in anti-terror grants since its inception, many of which went to such unlikely terrorism targets as Fargo, North Dakota, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and Canyon County, Idaho. Defense contractors that had previously served the Pentagon exclusively, CIR reported, have since shifted their focus to police departments, hoping to tap a new Homeland Security market bounty expected to be worth $19 billion annually by 2014. Police agencies have a whole new source of funding for their war gear. Just as they'd done with the 1033 program, they'd initially argue that the equipment was necessary just in case of the rare school shooting or Al-Qaeda attack in Fond du Lac. But once they get the gear, they use it for drug raids. But in Keene, there was some resistance to the Bearcat. It began with Mike Clark, a 27-year-old handyman. Clark, who'd had a couple encounters with Keene police that he described as negative, read about the Homeland Security grant in the newspaper. "The police are already pretty brutal," Clark told me in February 2012. "The last thing they need is this big piece of military equipment to make them think they're soldiers." On February 9, 2012, more than 100 people packed a meeting of a city council committee, nearly all to oppose equipping the Keene Police Department and its 45 sworn officers with a Bearcat. One speaker quoted in the Keene Sentinel was Roberta Mastro Giovanni, owner of a newsstand downtown. "It promotes violence," Mastro Giovanni said. "We should promote more human interaction rather than militarize. I refuse to use money for something this unnecessary when so many people in our community are in need." Lenco spokesman Jim Massery dismissed critics who asked why a town with almost no crime would need a $300,000 armored truck. "I don't think there's any place in the country where you can say, that isn't a likely terrorist target," Massery told me. "How would you know? We don't know what the terrorists are thinking. Our trucks save lives. They save police lives. And I can't help but think that the people who are trying to stop this just don't think police officers' lives are worth saving." It's a line of argument defenders of militarization use often. Oppose the arming of cops as if they were soldiers. And you must secretly want cops to be killed on the job. But the video Lenco was using to market the vehicle to police departments didn't exactly emphasize negotiation. The camera viewpoint in the video was similar to that of a shooter video game. The soundtrack was AC/DC's Thunderstruck. Cops dressed in camouflage toted assault weapons, piled in and out of the Bearcat, and took aim at targets from around and behind the vehicle. They then attached a battering ram to the front of the vehicle, which they then used to punch a hole in the front door of a house, into which they injected canisters of tear gas. Lenko wasn't stupid. The company had chosen the images and music used in the video because they felt it would appeal to those police departments in the market for a Bearcat. Dori Omira, a 13-year resident of the town, told me, "Keene is a beautiful place. It's gorgeous, and it's safe, and we love it here. We just don't want to live in the kind of place where there's an armored personnel carrier parked outside of City Hall. It's just not who we are." According to CIR's research, DHS gave out $2 billion in grants in 2011, about four times the value of equipment given out through the 1033 program. As with the Byrn and COPS grants, the DHS grant program also got a big boost in President Obama's 2009 economic recovery package. The CIR investigation also found that DHS makes little effort to track how the grants are spent once they're sent. Nor does it track how the equipment is used once it has been purchased. The agency also doesn't seem to care if the recipients of the grants are places that face any tangible threat of terrorism. Hence, a city like Fargo, North Dakota, has been able to get its hands on $8 million in grants, which the police department has used to buy assault rifles, Kevlar helmets, and an armored truck with a rotating turret. Fargo Police Lieutenant Ross Renner attempted to defend the city's armament. "It's foolish to not be cognizant of the threats out there," he said, "whether it's New York, Los Angeles, or Fargo. But until the day when the next Muhammad Atta casts rage-filled eyes on North Dakota, the department hasn't made much use of its gun-fitted armored truck." CIR reported that it's mostly used for show, including at the annual city picnic, where police parked it near the children's bouncy castle. Elsewhere, CIR found that in Augusta, Maine, with fewer than 20,000 people, and where an officer hasn't died from gunfire in the line of duty in more than 125 years, police bought eight $1,500 tactical vests. Police in Des Moines, Iowa, bought two $180,000 bomb-disarming robots, while an Arizona sheriff is now the proud owner of a surplus army tank. And in Montgomery County, Texas, the sheriff's department owns a $300,000 pilotless surveillance drone, like those used to hunt down Al-Qaeda terrorists in the remote tribal regions of Pakistan and Afghanistan. A couple months before the CIR report, the sheriff in Montgomery County had broached the possibility of arming his drone with rubber bullets, or possibly tear gas. "No matter what we do in law enforcement, somebody's going to question it. But we're going to do the right thing."